Whom of you was ever bothered while sending a text document, a simple text document, to somebody else because of file formats, because the other person couldn't read the file? Well, there's some, at least a fair number. So we know that file formats are important, that open file formats are important, because if we want to exchange documents, we'll need them, or we all need to use the same software, but we don't want to. Or who always wants to rely on Microsoft Word? I don't hope that these are too many people. So this time, we'll get Arjun came from the Netherlands to us to talk about the use of open file formats in governmental administration. And he was successful in changing the use of open of document formats in administrations. So please welcome Arjun.
Thanks for that. Can everybody hear me? For the people in the back of the room, some of my texts contain more slides than what I normally do, so there are still seats, more seats in the front. Come forward if you like. Some of the house rules, I'm not going to comment on them. You can all read. So those are in effect as of now. Okay. I've been doing open source lobbying, which basically involves talking to administrators and politicians for many years, and for many years that I was doing it, it was sort of, you know, on my own time and stuff like that. And people kept asking me, Arjun, you're doing all this, you know, great open source lobbying work, but you're not making any money off it. And then I would say, Dad, I'm trying. And so last year we founded a little company, which is called Gendo, which means a way of the source in Japanese. And so what we used to do as volunteers, we now do professionally. And this is the blurb. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Now, the M-word will be used today, but it's not about them. They're a symptom. They're not the disease. They're not even the problem. They're just a symptom. But yeah, we all have run into them at some point in our lives, I guess. So everybody knows the examples, and that's what makes them useful. So this is my far plan, 5 points. Most of it will be on point 3 and 4, but I want to do the why, because understanding why is, I think, important in the whole argumentation. Now this is, I think, an important why. This is a piece of text that you can find online. It's a British cabinet memo out of the summer of 2002. That's 9 months before the invasion of Iraq. And it says that the British intelligence people have been talking to the American intelligence people, and they're reporting back to the British government and says, well, basically we've decided to go, decision has been taken, we just need to sort of massage public opinion a little bit. And we're going to justify it by talking about terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, we all know that none there, but we're fixing the intelligence around the policy. So this was 9 months before the war. Now, you can look that up. It's great fun. But the important thing here is, how do we get hold of that document? Well, we didn't get it from, you know, our government, which should tell us the stuff but doesn't, or our TV or newspapers or anything like that, because it's new media that allows us to retrieve this kind of information and then share it and do things with it. And of course, new media, as some people still call it, mainly dinosaur people, is of course based mainly on free and open source software and open standards. And we call it the internet or the net or shorter like that. So this is one important thing, I think, to have open information and really open and really transparent. We need that, and we need free and open source and open standards. So, hang on. Yeah, okay. So, a computer is not about technology. A computer is not a better typewriter. It's not a technological issue. A computer is a better printing press. And so it's a free speech and civil liberties issue. Computers, operating systems, software, standards, information networks, all that stuff is like the printing press, and we should surround them with the same sort of checks and balances that we surround freedom of the press with, because, of course, freedom of the press is not worth a hell of a lot if one or two companies own all the presses privately. That would be bad. You know, we want the rights to have to, you know, we want to be able to choose between O'Reilly and this other guy. I mean, it's, you know, it's cool to have choice. We don't want concentrations. So this is an example of a bit of a problem with the software license. If you use a certain software package, then this is in the license. And so the guy selling you the typewriter is saying you can't use the typewriter to type letters that say nasty things about me, which is kind of, you know, if there was a sticker on a typewriter or on a pen that says you can't say nasty thing about the Parker Corporation, I don't think you would buy the pen, but many people use this kind of software. So there are many other reasons for wanting free and open source software and open standards, especially in government. These are some of the reasons. We want to, you know, everybody needs to be able to access all the data. It needs to be transparent how the information processes work. We want our national states to be independent of commercial corporations, of course. We want digital data to be accessible 50 or 100 years from now. National sovereignty, if you are the Chinese Ministry of Defense, you do not want to run all your computers on Windows. I mean, that's strategically not very clever. So there are many, many reasons, and everybody should just basically choose the one you like and talk about them. Okay. So how did I get started in this? Well, I live there, in the Netherlands, and the Netherlands has the lowest Firefox adoption of all of Europe, I regret to say. I hope it's going to change a bit now. And that's been true for quite some while. This is 6 months old data, so things might be a bit better now. And in the Netherlands, for a long time, it was there were many sort of government places and banks and things that were online that you couldn't, you know, you could only use Internet Explorer. You could not use Firefox or its predecessors. So on January 1st, 2002, I went to the Dutch railway site to plan a rail trip, as I often do. And instead of the planner, it showed me this. And it says in Dutch, you know, this site works with Internet Explorer. If you don't have Internet Explorer, go download Internet Explorer here. And of course, I was running Linux. So that kind of sucked. So I couldn't plan my train trip that day. And I was really pissed about that because I'm a fairly good customer of the railway system. I give them a lot of money every year. So I decided to write a rather angry email to the webmaster of the National Railway. And having finished the mail, which had become quite long and well argued, I thought, well, I can send it to him, but then probably nothing's going to happen because he's just a technical guy. He's not in charge of policy, so nothing will happen. So there was this gleaming CC field in my mail client. So I thought, aha. Okay, so I looked up all the IT specialists of all the political parties in the Netherlands and put them in, and the ombudsman, and, you know, the minister for transport, and about 50 other people. And then it looked really nice, so I sent that off. And then in 17 days, the Dutch National Railway changed its site. They had it revamped, and then it was standards compliant. Now, that wasn't only because of my email, because they got mails from literally hundreds of people, but I think the CC list sort of, you know, got their attention a bit. And I also got into contact with a member of parliament who mailed me back and said, hey, this is weird, and I've been hearing more stuff about this. You know, what's the real problem, and let's talk about this. So I went to The Hague on my free day and started talking with them. And one talk became another talk and became another talk, and we started writing things down and what's the real problem here. And he said, well, we're going to make this into a, you know, I'm going to bring this to parliament and see what we can do. And so on the 19th of November 2002, this was one day after the American Securities Exchange Commission published the profit margins that Microsoft has on Windows and Office, which is quite obscene, certainly at that time. It was like 90% or something like that, and that was in all the papers. And the next day, Mr. Vendrick, a member of parliament for the Green Party, put this motion into the parliament, and it was accepted unanimously, which is quite special for a Greens Party motion. That doesn't happen all that much. And the motion really says two things, and it's known for the second part, which is about open source, but the first part is just as important. It says the software market doesn't work as a market should, and there is vendor lock-in, and there are problems, and there are high cost of transition, and therefore the government needs to take action to correct that, to create a normal situation. And then it says, one of the ways of doing this is by adopting open standards and open source software. So that was 2002. And that was basically for me to start. Now, Green Party member doesn't get unanimous motion. So from then on, Case and me, we were best buddies, and I could call him, and he would call me back, and all that kind of good stuff. And I kept sort of feeding him data and helping him out in this dossier and making it bigger and better and more beautiful. And other members of parliament got on board from the Socialist Party and from the Labour Party and all left wing still. But, you know, we were getting somewhere and we were getting a bigger chunk of parliament basically to work with us on things. And so we were helping them, you know, get positive press and score points and do things. And of course, depending on what party you're talking to, you have to sort of adapt your talk a little bit. So I'm going to show you a little bit of the Dutch political spectrum from left to right, more or less. I know these are old concepts, but it still works a little bit. So we have the Greens, we have the Socialist Party, Labour Party, Christian Democrats, which are always in the middle, the VVD, which is sort of comparable to the British Conservatives, I guess, in a way. And we have the LPF and the PVV, which I think is even more right, but that's my personal opinion. Now, there are all kinds of issues that you can say this is why it's important. So things like social inclusion, transparency of vendor neutrality, open markets, lower cost. Everybody likes lower cost. Lower cost is always good. But other things, you know, other things, you might get traction with left-wing parties and not with other parties. I think, but I've never tried it, that national security might be sort of more of a right-wing issue. I'm not sure. Local businesses is certainly something that the VVD latched onto. So there is something there for everybody if you sort of, you know, look around a bit. So then, basically not much happened for a while, but then in 2004, the government really messed up, and that was great for us because we needed a good example, and they gave it to us. They tried to purchase 150 million euros worth of desktop software, and they didn't follow the EU procurement rules for buying stuff. Basically, if you buy anything over €250,000 as a government, you need to do, you know, European tendering, blah, blah, blah. They didn't. They only talked to a single vendor. And so that was a kind of an oops thing, and Brussels started writing very angry letters and all that things. And the civil servant leaked the info on December 10th. We got a phone call, as we sometimes do. And of course, then, you know, we called other people that we know and stuff like that. So the next day, news sites carried the story, and it was in like the IT press and also on Slashdot on December 12th. And of course, we were mailing our members of parliament. So on December 14th, the first questions were asking parliament, and by December 17th, the contract was dead in the water. And that saved the Dutch taxpayer a ton of money. So that was good. But things got better and better. Then the government admits we have a problem. And of course, we all know, you know, the first step in overcoming an addiction is admitting you have a problem. So this is, you know, when they did it. So this was for us really the best part of the whole thing. It wasn't even about the 150 million. I mean, this was the best part. Because now for the first time, we had a government, a cabinet document saying we are too dependent, this is a problem, and we're going to do something about it by using open source software and open standards. So then that really sort of gave it a little push. And of course, the words like vendor lock and monopolist are actually mentioned in the document. So that was all good. So this is sort of part of building a dossier, which is something you need to do, and it takes years generally to slowly build a series of cases where it's clearly shown that there is a problem and this is the direction of the solutions, and you need to document it, and you need to have basically other people saying it for you so you won't have to say it yourself. So if you can get a cabinet minister, even by mistake, to say we have a problem and open source is the solution, and you need to, you know, get that, underline it, photocopy it, and it's part of your dossier, and you can use that for years. It's great. So that was all part of the software building. Now, meanwhile, we are doing local stuff. So this is the city of Groningen, where I was born, in the north of the Netherlands. They were going to do a 5-year enterprise contract also for their some of the desktop stuff and some of their other office stuff. And we were called by one of the techie guys there, and he said, oh, tonight there's going to be a council meeting, and they're going to decide on buying all this new stuff for €1.5 million or something. And you guys need to come here and explain to them that it's really a bad choice. So one of my co-founders of Gendo and me, we jumped in the car, we were calling our MPs in The Hague, telling them to call their local party, you know, fellow party members in Groningen, tell them, you know, we're in the car, we're coming, we need 25 minutes of your time to explain something, which is about a lot of money. And so they gave us some of their time, and we talked to various representatives of the various local parties there, and we said, well, why are you buying this stuff? And they said, well, you know, it's a new version, we're upgrading, we're always doing that. And yeah, but why are you buying this stuff? Is there anything in the new word processor that you need to do a better job as a government? You know, are you going to type out a better building permit with this new word processor? Is there any description of anything, functionality that you need to do your job to do it? And they said, well, no. Or we said, well, you have licenses already. It works. They will remain supported to 2011. Why not just not buy it? Why not just, you know, postpone buying anything to 2011, keep the money in your pocket and do something else with it. They thought that was an interesting idea. So they decided to do that. The funny thing was that one of the big Dutch IT press magazines was already printed by the time we were having that meeting. So on Friday, the paper said, Municipality of Groningen buys 1.5 million worth of Microsoft software, and obviously they hadn't, so that was kind of funny. They were a bit behind there. But then they said, we're going to use half the money to develop a migration scenario. So we're going to hire 4 guys locally in our municipality, and we're going to, you know, give them a couple of €100,000 to just develop a migration scenario, investigate what is required to go to alternatives and how much time it will take and all that stuff. And then the other half of the money we'll put in the bank and it'll just, you know, get interest, and it's always good. And then in 2010, we're going to reevaluate. And, you know, even if we don't decide to migrate, we'll have this migrate document, and that will be a very nice sort of, you know, piece of the negotiation with any, you know, potential vendor, because then we'll say, well, we have this migration document here to something that's free, that's already paid. So how much percentage, you know, reduction are you going to give us? You know, 80% or 90%? That'll be sort of the discussion. And of course, so money in the bank and 4 new jobs, which is always nice in a city with a high unemployment. Now, the province of Groningen, which is sort of the whole area around it, that's the sort of the middle layer of Dutch government. You know, you have national, province, and local. This is sort of the middle layer. They had a new IT plan for the next 5 years. And on open source, it said, there is no support for open source, period. That was the only thing it says about open source. So we thought, well, we need to do something here. And so we did some stuff. And then we had a new version of the strategic IT plan for 5 years. And it says, oh, we're going to do things with open office, open standards are important, local knowledge economy, interoperability, all those lovely buzzwords. And the difference is that 4 people, you know, went up there and each talked for 4 minutes to the provincial council. That was it. Now, it takes about a day to prepare those 4 minutes. So, yeah, I mean, it's not totally trivial, but it is relatively trivial in terms of effort to get this done. And the council was totally surprised that 4 people came to talk to them about this subject. So they sort of woke up, oh, this must be important. We'll have to study it further. And so they sort of, you know, told their civil servants to really look into it and come up with a new plan. And then those civil servants, of course, started mailing us for help, basically, because they were a bit lost. And so we got all our buzzwords in the plan. So then last year, the Dutch government imploded for the umpteenth time, and we got new elections and we got a new cabinet. And we got the Labour Party into Parliament, and then we, for the first time, we had sort of a direct line of communications to somebody actually in power. Instead of talking to members of Parliament, we could now talk to, you know, somebody who was actually running part of the government. So that was a whole new ballgame for us. And we had to make it attractive for him to do something. You know, we have to make it attractive for him to stick his neck out. This is the Minister of Economic Affairs of the Netherlands, young guy, under 40. Works all over the world, and not so long in government, so he still has a fairly fresh mind on things, and he's interested, he wants to do new things. And so we needed to make it attractive for him to help us and to stick his neck out. So that's what we set out to do, basically. And so at some point we got our first meeting with him. Now, we took a long time in preparing that, and in retrospect, I'm really glad we did that. So, you know, you get a 45-minute meeting. Now, you have to understand, of course, what we think, this is all very important, but you are not as important as the Saudi ambassador coming to talk about, you know, oil stuff. So if that guy shows up, you're out. I mean, it's that simple. So you need to make sure you get the core message across fast, because any meeting can be cut short at any time, because this thing is not as important as 1,000 other government stuff. Make it attractive to do something rather than nothing, so you need to show that there may be a risk, but there's an upside there somewhere. And you can tell these people lots of stuff in a quick time. They're smart. Well, this one is anyway. You need to help their staff too, because it's all new for them generally. So you need to, you know, have a thick info package with, you know, maybe demo CDs and lots of printed out articles and papers and stuff and slides and whatever. And the minister may have only 45 minutes, but his staff, which is a large group of civil servants, they have a lot more time. So, you know, make sure you take the rest of the afternoon off so you can go talk with them. And of course, pretty pictures can be helpful, so I'll show you some of it. And this entire presentation is Creative Commons licensed, so you can download it from the CCC site afterwards and have some fun with it. This is a picture one of our graphics guy made. This is what the Netherlands spends yearly on proprietary software licenses. Mostly this goes to North America. So it leaves our economy, enters the North American economy. That represents about 100,000 jobs, which basically we don't have in the Netherlands, but that is exported to America, which is kind of stupid. So it's a bling-bling vendor lock that we're all paying for to the tune of about 1% of our gross national product. So this picture really sort of showed the scope of the problem for the minister in one, you know, very nice picture that you need to have printed out, you know, on a big piece of paper and, you know, just give it to him and don't ask for it back and stuff like that. Don't be cheap. So this is how I explain to people the value of open standards. Open standards is like a common language. And if you want to do big, difficult building projects like this one that was attempted once long ago, if you don't have a common language, if you can't talk to each other, if you can't share information, then the things end badly, generally. So it's nothing. Yeah, well, exactly. Because they couldn't understand each other. Because suddenly they had, instead of one common language, they had 15 proprietary non-communicating languages. And then the whole thing went badly. And of course, this is often the state of many big government IT projects. And lack of open standards, of course, is clearly one of the things. So another way to explain it is containers. It's not about the boat, it's about the container. A container can be used to store all kinds of stuff, from trees to data centers, anything. And you can put it in all kinds of modes of transportation. But it's the standard definition of the container. It's an iron box, it's a certain size and stuff like that, that makes it flexible. Because for the lorry driver, it does not matter what's in the container. Right, and you can switch modes of transportation. It's very flexible. It's sort of like the internet, where you have this middle layer. You have the services on top. You know, it's the stuff that we have it for, like web and voice over IP and mail and stuff. And you have devices, you know, the shiny things. And but it's the middle layer that most people never talk about. But that's the important stuff. Because how is it possible that we have, what is it, 2 billion devices now hanging off the internet, all talking to each other? They're made by thousands of different vendors. And they have all kinds of different operating systems and applications, but it still can, you know, share all this stuff. It's the middle layer, so that's what's important. So this is IT architecture for beginners, basically, and other politicians. Services, that's the stuff that politicians always talk about, right? E-government, blah, blah, blah. And devices and software, that's what the techies always like to talk about, you know, the newest laptop or whatever, or the best operating system, and, you know, my Linux distribution is more scarce than yours and stuff like that. But it's the middle layer that's, of course, where the action is. Because if you have open standards, then the interoperability can occur. If you don't have open standards, basically, you're beholden to one or two vendors who will screw you out of a lot of money. Now, this is about source code. Not going to elaborate too much. I presume most people here know it. So that's how that works in a single page. Basically, you can explain this fast to someone. It's not hard. And this is what vendor lock is. Hardware layer commoditized, and the middle stuff very sort of vendor locked because all these layers are tied together. And, you know, if you have the one, you need to buy all the other stuff, whether you like it or not. And then, of course, you know, are you still the boss of your own information as a government? And if you do nothing, of course, it gets worse and worse and worse. And at some point, you're going to be totally sort of privatized, basically. So what you should strive for is say, okay, we have two flavors of software. One flavor is the generic stuff. That's the stuff that everybody has, like an operating system, word processors, file servers, web servers, databases, all that stuff, which is most of IT, most anywhere. And they only have special applications, say a management system for the sewage infrastructure of the city of Amsterdam. Now you need to, you know, either have somebody build that or make it yourself, whatever, code it yourself, but own it yourself. Be the owner of the intellectual property so you're not being controlled by an external company. And then, of course, you need to make sure that you can swap out all these layers and replace them by another commodity product. That's, you know, good IT architecture, basically. Also, what I learned through bitter experience, I might add, is that sometimes it's strategically clever to just talk about open standards, because some people, you know, think this free software, open source stuff is, ooh, that's scary, and it's, you know, made by bearded people and stuff like that. But open standards is really, you know, it's very hard to argue against open standards. It's very, very hard politically. So go there first and then sort of, you know, chuck in open source if it's possible afterward, basically. So that's in the Netherlands why we set up the Open Document Society, which is a non-profit organization that teaches, educates, and lobbies for open document formats, chiefly, and other sort of open standards. But open document formats is now our primary thing. And of course, if anybody wants to set up sort of a national branch in other European countries, please go to the site and, you know, tell us you want to get going, or come talk to me and I'll hook you up with the right people. Now, so over the last summer, we wrote a new policy document. We put lots of input into it. And from the talk page on Pentabarf, there was actually a link to the document in English, so you can download it and you can, you know, translate it and do beautiful things with it in your country. I'm pushing the government to release it under Creative Commons, so you can actually do that without any legal fears of being, you know, having done terrible things to you. And they've said they're going to do that, but we need to have the lawyers look at it a bit more. Three main things. What's it for? It needs to improve interoperability in the public sector. That is government plus all the other stuff that is sort of semi-tax funded, so schools and hospitals and libraries and, you know, all that stuff, which basically means 40 to 50% of all of Dutch society. It needs to improve the functioning, or it needs to lower the dependence on vendors, and we want to improve the functioning of IT markets and thereby supporting the Dutch knowledge economy. Those are the three goals of the policy. Now, lots of stuff has been said, and certainly in the Dutch IT press, certain companies have been lobbying like crazy to, you know, say all kinds of things about what the policy is and is not. And since I wrote part of it, I think I know something about it. So these are some of the facts, what it says. ODF becomes mandatory in next summer for a national government, and then it becomes a mandatory all over the year after that, and the rest of the public sector, which is the schools, hospitals, can trail 12 months. Open standards in general, you need to use them unless, you know, it's not available. If you have a clear business need to use AutoCAD and there is no open alternative and you can demonstrate that, by all means use that. The first year will have no sanctions, but in 2009 there will be sort of audits on compliance, and if people don't comply, then, you know, some sanctions will be devised. We're still working on that one, what it exactly will be. If governments are going to get new software, they need to get open source if that is of equal functionality. I think that is really great to sort of open up the market and give open source an equal chance in a market that doesn't really work. There is now a budget to, you know, do promotion, education, and pilots and stuff like that. So the government organizations who sort of are, you know, the first movers who take a bit of risk, they get some support. So that's good. The government is going to look into if it's possible to do separate hardware and software pricing in the Dutch market. So this is really something for consumers. So you have your, you know, whatever Toshiba laptop lying in the window, and they'll say the laptop is so many euros, and then, you know, the Windows license on it is that much, and the Norton antivirus that comes with it is that much, and the power DVD. And if you say, I don't want all of that, then you get your money back for that part, which really lowers the cost of your laptop and doesn't send any money to corporations you may not like. So that's good. And of course, the Dutch Antitrust Authority has been asked to investigate. Now, they have been asked sort of in a way that says, you know, you need to do this because otherwise there will be political trouble. I just got a letter from them just before coming to Berlin that they say they're not going to because they don't see any problem. So I think next January, when the parliament is back from its, you know, Christmas holidays, there will be political trouble, because basically parliament has been asking them unanimously for 5 years to look into it. If they don't want to do that, there is going to be a shitstorm. Now, there's also some FUD going around about the plan. It doesn't make open source mandatory. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, if you have a good reason for not using open source, fine, you know, use something else. It doesn't forbid specific products. So, you know, if you want to use Pico or VI to generate those ODF files, you know, go ahead, or any other, you know, piece of technology. It doesn't forbid specific standards. So if a government organization wants to, you know, publish their documents in ODF, but also wants to produce them in Betamax, you know, we're fine with that. It's cool. I mean, or any other standard, of course. So this was our interesting day, December 12th. Intense lobbying by Microsoft. Now, we wrote briefings for both the members of parliament and the minister, which sort of helped the process along. It's called playing two sides of the game, and it really helps. And we added some new ideas into that to move the debate away from the core policy, because what we didn't want to happen is that in the parliament debate, the plan would basically be, you know, nibbled at the edges. So we said, oh, we're going to put in a bunch of new ideas, and we put them in both briefs. And so they discussed that and didn't discuss the policy, it's the core document, and that was adopted sort of in one go. So that works. And basically, the members of parliament and the minister were reading our mails to each other and agreeing, and everybody was happy and, you know, dancing in the sun and all that stuff. So it was really, really very cool. So some final points. Tiny, tiny country there. It's called the Netherlands, which right now is leading the charge in Europe in terms of policy, not necessarily in adoption, mind you. Of course, Norway's been doing comparable things. December 19th, they published their policy. Belgium has had a federal ODF policy for over a year, but right now they don't have a federal government, which, you know, is... They have an interim government, so they're cool. And of course, you know, in Germany we have places like Munich and many other towns that are doing very cool things and really stuck their necks out. I am, as we speak, in the process of trying to export this idea and the document and stuff to the UK, which is why I pushed so hard for an English translation. And I'm hoping to work together with, you know, other people in other countries to see if we can get this, you know, in Parliament there and on the policy, because we've sort of, you know how the trick works, and you know, we can maybe help out other people. So I'm hoping we can basically make, you know, get from Reykjavik to the Urals, make this an open standards zone. I think that would be cool. So somebody's going to need to lead that charge, basically, and that's going to cost you some time and some effort, and, you know, you need to not do other things, maybe watch less TV or whatever. It comes, I mean, it doesn't come with real personal risk. I was hit by a car a couple of weeks ago, and there were quite a few people who asked me, you know, if a certain corporation was involved, and there's no evidence for that, so I don't think so. People sometimes ask, aren't you afraid? And I said, no, I don't. I don't think they're that stupid. They're stupid, but not that stupid. But somebody needs to do it. I mean, the single thing I learned most is that if nobody does anything, then nothing changes. So, you know, you can be angry about if you're a German and you need to, you know, fill in your digital taxes on a Windows machine. You can be angry, but that's not going to change anything. What you need to do is, you know, get together with a bunch of people, write a very stern letter arguing it, and talk to the press and say, hey, you know, the national government is forcing me to buy products from a convicted monopolist, which is, you know, bad. They can usually understand it. Now, while you're doing that, you will be called all kinds of things. You know, I've been called an extremist and you know, all kinds of things. I've even been called an idealist, which in Dutch political sort of atmosphere right now is really a sort of a bad term. It's really something you want to avoid. And if somebody calls me an idealist, they always say, yeah, of course I'm an idealist, and why aren't you, and stuff like that. And so it's a bit like most of these people, when they were doing their thing, that's a letter Jacobs, for those of you who aren't Dutch. She was the woman who said women should have a vote in the Netherlands in 1910. And she was called an extremist, and she was laughed, and of course eventually women got the vote, and I don't think anybody wants to change that. So most of these people at some point have been called extremists. He's been called a terrorist, actually, and, you know, so there you go, things change. So, you know, the first phase where they ignore you is going to last quite long, generally. I mean, it's, you know, it ramps up. So you're going to be ignored for quite some time. It's going to be quite frustrating, and you're going to be laughed at for quite some time. That's going to be frustrating, too. And then they fight you, and then you know, ha, we're getting somewhere. When companies start making you offers to quit for money, then you really know you're getting somewhere. And then, of course, you win. Because, of course, this is the way the world goes. Now, one of the things that in talking with government people, they always said, well, this is such a big problem, you know, we'd rather not do it because it's so difficult, it's so complex to switch all these government organizations over and all that stuff. And it always reminded me of this story about Napoleon, who one day was riding along with his generals along a road, south of France, hot sun, woolen uniforms, everybody was sweating, and even though the horses were doing all the work. And so Napoleon had sort of an idea right there, and he said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to plant trees along all the roads in France, and then the trees will give shade, and the soldiers can march in the shade, and they will be much fitter when they come to the battlefields, which, you know, is a very good idea. Now, of course, all the generals didn't want to be involved in, you know, something that looked like agriculture and gardening, so they all started to think up reasons very quickly why that couldn't be done, and why it shouldn't be done, and why it was very difficult and impossible. And then one of the generals said, well, Mr. Bonaparte, you do realize that it takes a long time, and it'll take 20 years before the trees are tall enough to provide the shade. And of course, Napoleon then said, well, of course I know that. That's why I want you to start planting tonight. Because it's a big problem, and a big problem, it shouldn't be the reason to put off the solution. It's a reason to start right now. So that's what I've been repeating. So, basically, in Europe, full speed ahead. Beware of icebergs. Things do go wrong sometimes. You can have political mishaps. Sometimes going too fast can be a bit dangerous. You need to pick your battles and all that, you know, strategy stuff. Read Sun Tzu and, you know, all that good things. Just so that nobody thinks I'm taking credit for all of this, I didn't do this alone, not by a long shot. The The Business Software Alliance, our marketing organization, has done great work for us over the years, especially in the Netherlands, many other groups. Free software community, politicians, civil servants, Albert Hasenberg for too many things, and Annie, of course, for putting up with me over 16-hour working days and midnight emailing, all that other stuff, and my parents, basically, who never complained about the fact that I wasn't making money when I was doing this. They always supported me. So thank you all for this. And I think after having a drink of water, I'm ready to answer some questions, if there are any. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah. What's with a government-financed software that is developed by some small software studio? Has it to be an open-source solution also?
Under the new policy, anything that is developed with public resources, the intellectual property becomes owned by the government and therefore by all of us.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But that's a new idea, so it's just sort of, just now become policy.
Hello? Hi.
Hello.
Do you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm involved with the FFI. We are a European organization who also works on open standards. And tomorrow I will present this OXML fight, which is somehow... probably will be adopted somehow this maybe this year. And my question is very simple. This definition of open standards is somehow... there is some definitions made by some standardization bodies. Mm-hmm. There is one proposed, but which is not official, by the EIF group of the European Commission. What's your definition of open standards?
We use the definition that is used by the Information Society of the European Commission. We like that one, which was also the one that put the federal government of Belgium into their policy. We've actually asked for one extension to the policy, which is still being debated, and that says ODF will become a mandatory standard. Now, in the future, it's possible to expand that with other standard, which made Microsoft jump for joy. Sort of, it was their sort of way out, they thought. And then what the federal government in Belgium did, they said, well, if we add new standards in the future, meaning, for instance, maybe OOXML or whatever. If we do that, that standard, whatever it is, needs to be backwards compatible with ODF. Which is, it's one line of text in the policy document, and you got them, and it's really cool.
Yeah, but my question was especially on patents, because the whole core issue about the definition of open standards is about RAND.
The definition that we use says it needs to be free from patents and other things that might hinder, for instance, open source developers and re-implementation. Yeah.
So RFRAND is okay for you?
Sorry?
RFRAND, which is the ISO policy for standards, which is royalty free and reasonable and non-discriminatory.
No, the Dutch government really wants reasonable. It's difficult. It's difficult to define that, what is reasonable, because $10,000 fee is not much for an IT company, but it might be a lot for 19-year-old students. So I think we like to sort of, you can get the standard at the cost of the media of distributing it. So, if burning the standards document to a CD-ROM costs €2, then they can charge you €2 for it, but not 10,000 euros.
Okay, here. I once got a recommendation by one of the staff in Sweden, political staff, and they said, people come here and describe problems all the time, and they spend a lot of time describing the problem and very little time on describing the solution. Mm-hmm. And when you pitch something to a politician or their staff, you use a very short time to describe the problem and a very long time to describe the solution.
Definitely.
Because they know about a lot of problems, they want solution, that's what they want. Yeah. Is this your...
sometimes they're not aware of the problems. I mean, I've seen it a lot. I've had one fairly senior civil servant IT manager of a Dutch city, I'll forgo the name, and he said to me at some point, I was doing a presentation sort of like this one, there at their request, and he said, well, Mr. Kamphuis, of course, you're right that we are a bit vanderlocked here in this town, but I don't see a problem with the desktop monopoly because Microsoft allows us to do anything we want with our computers. And now this is clearly a person who really doesn't understand the problem yet, so you need to do a bit more explaining, and then you need to come up with a solution too. I agree with you on that totally. But sometimes you really need to explain the very basics of the problems. And many civil servants seem to have forgotten their oath that they need to, you know, uphold the constitution and serve the public and not software companies. So you need to remind them of that sometimes. I'm going to let other people pick. Just shove microphones. Yeah, go.
Hello, Ariane.
Hi.
Congratulations for your work, and thank you for this inspiring presentation. I think that many of your conclusions sound really likely, really much like what we think from the similar issues in mm-hmm. France. And I'll be delighted if we had the occasion to work together on those issues.
Okay, cool.
You're the proof that individuals can do stuff, and that's a very good thing, I know, and it's worth reminding. I've got a small question in form of some little poking.
Mm-hmm.
I like very much the way you display the arguments regarding to the different political sensitivities of people. First of all, I think that there is one very efficient argument for right-wing people, that is the national competitiveness, saying that the local national industries
yeah.
will be favored and we gain advantage compared to yeah. other countries. This yeah. is very efficient.
Yeah, local and businesses, the University of Maastricht, MERIT, the MERIT uh-huh, project yeah. did a very yeah, good study on that.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can Google
exactly.
for it, and it's a great document, and yep. you can shove that into, you know, you can
exactly.
give the summary to the top guy and the rest of the document to his staff, so, yeah. and it's really great stuff.
This is very efficient, and I just wanted to, yeah, my question was, on all those arguments, many of them sound like they're, to me, like they're more into the free software
yep.
side than on just the open source pragmatic business yep. ideology. So is there a special reason that you use more the word open source than free software?
Like many people, I think I learned about open source and free software pretty much about the same time, but open source has just been doing a better job of marketing. So at least some people, I mean, in the political landscape, have heard of open source. Free software is an unknown term. I just wanted them to listen to the concept at all. I mean, I don't want to start by explaining the difference between the two, because that's going to be quite convoluted. So mostly I just use open source, but certainly for an audience like this, I think it's important to always sort of be aware of the basics where, you know, Stallman started. That ultimately, this is not about efficiency questions, it's about basic civil liberties. But sometimes you need to argue the money thing sort of to get the foot in the door, so I'll do that if that's necessary.
Just a question, yeah? Okay. So again, thanks very much for the efforts, really appreciate it. First of all, just for the anecdote about Napoleon, and I'm French, I'm coming from the south of France. If you travel down there, you will see many rows with the actual trees planted from that decision. So
oh,
it's
cool.
not just a myth or whatever. They really are, and we regularly smash cars on the trees for that. So that's just the anecdote. But then my question was about the Titanic picture, and you said the mistakes that are made. I'm really interested to have some feedback on maybe something that went wrong or some mistakes you made, because typically with this kind of situation, right after that kind of decision is made or right before, we have Flying Steve coming from the United States trying to change the policies around, and suddenly the words in the text change to allow some backwards compatibility or not, and many little words like this that change that makes a huge difference. To give a recent example, just in Nigeria, they bought, I think, 17,000 computers with Mandriva Linux
yep.
pre-installed
yep.
on them, and they're going to install Windows on them. Just a sudden decision after two few weeks after the decision, pretty surprising. So if you have any such maybe bad experiences like this, could you please share with us?
There have been many, also in the Netherlands. Also in the city of Amsterdam, we had a big software procurement gone bad, basically, where the city was going to buy for 3.5 million euros worth of software, and that hadn't gone through a procurement process either. So then one of the city council members basically had to leave. It was, you know, kicked out, and then ended up in parliament again, which sort of makes you wonder, but that's how these things go. But it is often from these kinds of screw-ups that you get sort of the momentum where you can go up to, you know, a parliamentarian or a council member and say, this is an example of a much bigger problem, and if you like, I can talk to you about this. I can explain something, and, you know. So sometimes almost you need organizations to mess up so you can get a foot in the door, and then, because then it's in the papers, you know, somebody screwed up, there's going to be a very angry letter from Brussels, they're going to get fined possibly even. And then it's politically a hot item. The city of Leiden, which is a smaller town in the Netherlands, we also have an office there, they messed up their licensing. And they were fined by the Business Software Alliance for 450,000 euros. And they had to pay that, you know, right now, immediately. And they didn't have the cash. It's a small town. So they had to do a special loan with a special bank. And of course, it was a political disaster. And we got in. Because then it's suddenly it's a political item because, you know, heads are rolling. So the mistakes can be your best moments, basically. And of course, the Business Software Alliance is our marketing tool. And it's they're great. I mean, whenever they've been somewhere, we go there and we have good conversations with people. So. Question? Yeah.
I'm interested in, do you get any feedback by the actual user? You want to use the, open source software? For example, if you have someone in public office who used the Redmond office for years, now he has to switch to an open office, what not always works as well as it should. Do you get those reactions, or are those people just forced into the software they have to use and you only talk to the government?
No. We've had quite good feedback on a group of civil servants from the city of Amsterdam who have already switched. And they say, you know, it works fine. I mean, there's no problem. You know, there's a little bit of a learning curve, but then there's a learning curve every so many years when they switch office versions anyway. Because, you know, when they switched from Office 2000 to 2003, all of them, you know, got an afternoon of coursework too. So then when they switch from 2003 to OpenOffice, they get an afternoon of coursework and it worked fine. And as studies, and one of my business, my company actually is also running another company that specializes in training people. And their experiences now and various other researches have confirmed this, that switching from Office 2003 to 2007 is much more training intensive than from 2000 to 2003 to, for instance, OpenOffice. Because the interfaces are a lot more the same. So yes, there are training costs, but there are always training costs. And the only question is which is more and how much, a big chunk of that. And of course, it's only once. You switch once, and then, you know, for the rest of eternity, you have free software for that part of your IT architecture. But in general, the people who are properly trained, which is very important, have no problem with it. And you must only switch to people if you can provide good applications. So if people need Photoshop to do their work professionally, please give them Photoshop. And if they need AutoCAD to do their work, you know, don't take that stuff away from them. But if they just need a word processor and a web browser and a mail client to do their work, and maybe a terminal window into some big mainframe thing somewhere, it doesn't matter what the underlying OS is. It just needs to be, you know, stable and cheap. I know a few that sort of do that. So.
Okay, a public relations thing. Is it better to say those politicians who oppose open standards and open source are somehow damp or are somehow corrupt? So what suits your needs better?
We've never been able to prove corruption. We've never had solid information on that in any way. I've had my doubts sometimes because, I mean, there's lots of stuff that you can explain by just people not knowing or just by stupidity. I mean, but of course, it only goes so far. I mean, at some point, you have to think, I mean, come on, people. So personally, the Antitrust Authority, after having been asked repeatedly, you know, we organized letter campaigns over the last few years. So IT professionals writing to the Antitrust Authority saying, I'm an IT professional, this is what I do, and I see problems with the Dutch IT market, please look into it. You know, they're not saying it's that problem or that problem. They just say, please look into it, because there are indications that there are problems. And so for the last 5 years, they've been structurally refusing to even do the research, saying we don't see a problem. And yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, integrity questions come into play. But we've never been able to prove anything so far. So I generally tend to write it up as just stupidity, or just, you know, not being capable, basically, which is also very bad, but slightly less bad than being corrupt.
Hello?
Were more hands?
One here.
Yeah, over there.
Hello. Yes, you made some comments that you wanted to help out the English with our problems with Microsoft software. I suggest you just watch us and laugh, because the situation is so bad. We have Microsoft Advisor in government pretty much writing the policy, so there's almost nothing that you can reason with them at that point. And you will see every single unbelievable loophole an excuse that they can produce now. And so at the moment, a lot of software is now being bought for schools. So they do this wonderful bundling up where they say, we buy the entire school from the company, including the bricks and the computers and the software, and then it's nothing to do with the government. And there's many, many different cheats in there. But if you've got any other comments, if you know what's happening in England.
Okay, well, we've already had discussions with a group of people in the UK, with UK parliamentarians, so we're going to go ahead. And we just start off with the opposition party and then slowly sort of move in. Just like, I mean, this is what you're describing is exactly what we had in the Netherlands. Some of the responses we got from government asking, after questions had been asked in parliament about certain issues over the last few years, of course, then those responses would be a Word file. So then, you know, the parliamentarians got the Word file, they would mail it to us, we would open it and sort of, you know, look into all the data, and then it would turn out that it was written on a PC owned by Microsoft the Netherlands or by one of their business partners. So those people would actually be writing the answers for the minister to parliament. That was sort of, so we had that situation too. And I don't know, maybe, you know, something needs to burst out in flames in the UK and then we need to grab onto that, something like that. I mean, maybe another NHS failure or something. I mean, you know, 10 billion here, 10 billion there, so pretty soon you're talking about real money, and then you get some political will maybe to do something. But it could take years, but fine, whatever, we'll go. Any other questions? Yeah.
During the last 10 years or so, where we know about open standards and are at least aware about that open standards matter, there was no real advocacy movement for open standards. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised in the summer. We found out we had the debate in the Bundestag here in Germany, and I tried a Google write on open standards and found very, very few documents which reflect what the technologists think what open standards are. And there was a lot of marketing garbage and so on. So no real platforms for open standards. And we were also very surprised that all these domain names like OpenStandards.eu and OpenStandards.de, OffeneStandards.de, they were all free. Yeah, so we could get them. My question is, during the last 10 years, it was, at least this was my perception, that somehow Microsoft had lobbyists that put down the flames that came out of administration, but there was no real movement for open standards pressuring the politicians. Just single letters from individuals. But now these kind of organization building is going on. Do you think that that we will see a kind of domino effect?
I think I'm not sure. Of course, I'd like to be optimistic about these things. I think we have turned a bit of a corner in Europe. So there's several countries now adopting, many others looking into it. I mean, in France, many ministries and like the gendarme have already switched. French Parliament is, you know, using Ubuntu on the desktop. So there are lots of things going on everywhere, and of course it's clearly in Europe's sort of interest to move in this direction, given sort of the historic way the software market works globally. But it's not going to come easy. I mean, I think, you know, the switch that is needed in the Netherlands, in my perception, is going to take at least a decade. And, you know, well, so be it. I mean, but I'd rather start that decade now than in 5 years from now, when it would probably not take a decade, but 15 years, because we're going to be sort of, you know, DRM'd up to the eyebrows, and it will be much harder to switch. So that is one of the things I would like to sort of advise to everybody. Every year, every additional year you wait after today, it's going to be harder, because DRM and all those kinds of technologies will also be used to make it harder to switch. They will tie documents to applications, to operating systems, to hardware. You know, the vertical integration is going to be a lot more in the future than it is now. So if you think it's hard to switch now, just wait 5 years and it's going to be hell to pay to do it. So people need to sort of, you know, get started as soon as possible, basically. But I mean, the reason why there was no lobbying, there was no commercial interest. I mean, you know, commercial companies, they have budgets for this stuff. I mean, literally, we're talking literally hundreds of millions of euros per year are spent on professional lobbyists. So these are, you know, very well-educated people with all kinds of special training and, you know, the best suits and a big expense account. And they take people out to lunch and they have all day to do this stuff. And, you know, we mostly just did it in our free time, you know, alongside other stuff you do to pay the rent. So, of course, you're not as professional, you're not as well. But slowly you can build up a good story. And, you know, the basics of our story is very solid. And in the end, I think we won on that, not, you know, because of our shiny cars or beautiful suits. So, but it's an uphill fight initially, at least. Yeah. In the back.
Hello, I'm representing Free Software Macedonia. We have developed some recommendations for the government, similar to your policy. But we are trying to push that policy decision to be only made within the government. We are not. We haven't actually tried to put it on the discussion board in the parliament. Do you think that there is any decision? We now think that it's much harder. Because
it can help if you have a person in your government who needs to make that decision, but he may you know, need to be convinced because some of his civil servants are bothering him and saying, oh, this is very risky, you shouldn't do that. If he then can say, well, I might not want to do it, but I'm being pressured by parliament, that gives him sort of cover. Uh-huh. So it can help some political people if there is pressure from that side, you know, of the system. But mm-hmm. It all depends on sort of the local situation.
And if I may say something, because in Macedonia, 170,000 computers in the education are going to use Ubuntu, mm-hmm. Which the decision was made only because there were significant cost. It was very cost efficient. Mm-hmm. But although there are two documents, one... regarding open standards and one regarding use of free software in the government, we cannot see much development in that mm-hmm. area besides education. So how much do you think that within a year the period is enough for switch to open standards?
I think you really need to clearly document the reasoning for wanting that kind of change. Because if you just argue on the cost and nothing else, then a couple of companies will fly in and say, oh, we'll give you all everything for free. So now our stuff is free too. And then you will be locked in again for another, you know, whatever, 5 years. So I think it's important to argue the other issues besides the price, although the price may get you in. But I think it's very important to document all the other stuff and say there's principal reasons why we want to use, in education especially, we want to use tools that say sharing knowledge is good. And we don't want to use tools that say sharing information gets you into prison. I mean, I think that's just a bad educational message, basically. So I think by adding those sorts of elements, you add extra sort of, you know, deadbolts into locking yourself in that course. Last question, because there's people after this. Yes.
My question. Do you hear me? No.
It works. Yeah, it's working.
Agree. Okay. My question concerns the political organizing you're doing. It seems like you built yourself some kind of local freedom task force in the Netherlands, and I think it's pretty good, and you had much luck, but. Did you do some networking, like contacting organizations like FSF Europe, who have those fellowship thing to build like, the task force you built up in other European countries?
We had any funding. We never had any mandate. We had mail contact. I mean, I know, you know, the president of FSF Europe quite well, for instance, George. But mostly it was just literally a handful of people. I mean, literally three or four people doing it on their own time. It was only sort of over the last half year that we could actually do it for pay. You know, we could do some consulting on it and get money for it. Up to then, it was just sort of advanced citizenship, basically.
And do you plan on sharing your experiences with other
Absolutely, absolutely. Anybody who wants the slides, anybody who wants me to come over and give a talk or do a workshop or, mail with you, or, you know, my mail address is on the site, so get in touch, and yeah, of course, totally. Okay, thank you.